Katrin Fry has more on a traveling sculpture that highlights banned books. And in our feature interview, reporter Evra O'Brien talks with a film programmer about Missoula's Roxy Theater and its future plans. Montana Department of Transportation has issued a permit allowing an Oregon company to haul a large water purification unit through northwestern Montana and into Canada for an oil sands project. The 225-foot-long load began moving on U.S. Highway 12 through northern Idaho Monday night, despite the protests of Nez Perce tribal members and others, who argue the trucks should not be allowed to pass through tribal land or along the Lock Saw and Clearwater Rivers. Dwayne Williams, administrator of Montana's Motor Carrier Services Division, says the state issued a $3,195 permit today, allowing Omega Morgan to travel through Montana, beginning as early as tomorrow. The load is 21 feet wide and weighs 644,000 pounds. Omega Morgan wants to move at least 9 large loads along the 2-lane route.
And in other news from around the state, a man accused of killing a Sydney high school teacher wants state prosecutors to turn over the personnel files of the law enforcement officers who investigated the case. Keith Michael Spell's attorney says Spell has a right to the information, and it might cast doubt on officers' credibility. Deputy Richland County Attorney T.R. Halverson responded to defense attorney Al Avignon's April 30th request on Monday. Halverson asked District Judge Richard Simonton to deny the request because Avignon has not shown the files are relevant and the officers are entitled to a right of privacy. Simonton has not ruled on the request. Spell and Lester Van Waters Jr. have pleaded not guilty to charges of deliberate homicide and attempted kidnapping in the January 2012 slaying of Sherry Arnold, a popular math teacher.
The Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is looking to simplify fishing and hunting licenses in the state. Capitol reporter Dan Boyes tells us right now there are about 100 different types of licenses, and FWP wants to cut that down.
Okay, I'm going to get you to Debbie Holler. Hang on just a sec.
Administrative assistant Jolene Tatey works the front desk at FWP headquarters in Helena. She's been here for almost 18 years and says on any given day she may be selling dozens of different types of hunting and fishing licenses.
It depends on the day.
And many of the licenses change every 2 years when the legislature comes to town. She has to learn the new rules, and so do sportsmen.
It would be a lot easier for the public if we had a simpler licensing structure, no doubt.
FWP Information Bureau Chief Tom Palmer says there are about 10 different types of licenses just for elk hunting, 11 or 12 deer licenses.
We have a license for non-residents who used to live here. We have a license for non-residents who were born here.
There are discounted licenses, free ones.
All that stuff is good and perhaps good for business, but it gets complex.
The governor's office is asking the department to research a simpler structure. FWP Director Jeff Hagener has appointed a 12-member council to study the issue for the next half year or so. It's made up of hunters and anglers, state lawmakers, and chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Dan Vermillion. The council will try to streamline the process without reducing the amount of revenue coming in. Information Bureau Chief Tom Palmer says about 80% of FWP's overall funding comes from license sales. It's not always a reliable source. Non-resident license sales have been down the last couple years. Palmer estimates as much as $1 million annually.
Over the last year, there's been as much belt tightening in Fish, Wildlife, and Parks as we possibly can kind of do just with what we have available.
As much as she likes the idea of simplifying the process, Administrative Assistant Jolene Tatey says there are going to be hurdles. Revenue from some of those special licenses is earmarked.
They can only be spent on certain things. So when they start taking that earmark away, it's going to affect the program that it's tied to.
Palmer says the council will be looking at that and perhaps other ways for people to contribute to fish and wildlife conservation efforts besides traditional license sales. The council begins meeting August 13th. By next March, the group hopes to take recommendations to the public in order to craft a policy agenda for the 2015 legislature. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
A civil rights group is arguing that the Wolf Point School District is arranged to favor white voters in a predominantly Native American area. The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana filed a federal lawsuit today, arguing the districts are apportioned to give a predominantly white district greater say on the school board than American Indian residents. The ACLU argues it is an unconstitutional violation of the Voting Rights Act. The group is asking a federal judge to force the school board of trustees to draw new districts. ACLU legal director John Ellingson says the districts have not been redrawn to accurately account for their population. The Wolf Point School District website says 80% of its students are Native American. The district did not immediately return a call seeking comment.
Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt will headline the 6th Montana Economic Development Summit in Butte this September. Senator Max Baucus made that announcement today at a technology roundtable in Missoula. Schmidt is credited with helping build Google from a Silicon Valley startup into a tech titan.
I have been working on him for a little while. He didn't say yes right away. But he's definitely come and speak to us. And I'm very pleased. As you know, he's the executive chairman of Google. He was the guy that really helped develop Google, even though Larry Page and Sergey Brin kind of founded it. Another garage story. But Eric Schmidt was the guy who really is a force to help develop Google to be what it is today.
Baucus noted Google will also offer a workshop on September 17th, the summit's second day, to help small business owners create their own quality website. Other featured keynote speakers include Elon Musk of Tesla, Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, Delta's Richard Anderson, and Montana Tech graduate Ryan Lance of ConocoPhillips. Businesses interested in participating in the Butte Jobs Summit next month can find out more at montanajobsummit.com. Registration is required.
Governor Steve Bullock says a new online survey will allow state residents to offer economic development ideas. Bullock said that the surveys are part of the Main Street Montana project. The governor has been soliciting ideas from community and business leaders on ways to improve the job creation environment for the private sector. Bullock says all Montanans are encouraged to submit ideas with the survey. It can be found at mainstreetmontanaproject.com/survey. The governor tapped business leaders to lead the project. A final product is expected early next year. It is expected to cover everything from workplace development through education to government regulations.
Maya Angelou, J.D. Salinger, and the Apostles have something in common. The writers of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, The Catcher in the Rye, and The Holy Bible have all had their books challenged or banned. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on a sculpture visiting libraries across the state and highlighting these stories of censorship.
Everybody has certainly.
Bozeman artist George Cole tells a story of a teacher's warning to him years ago.
When I grew up in Laurel, Montana, I had an English teacher tell me, and obviously I'm 70 years old, that I should not read Catcher in the Rye, that it would harm me for life.
Needless to say, Cole read J.D. Salinger's novel, which is now required reading in many English classrooms.
It heightened my life. It brought new joys and experiences and led me to other forms of literature that is open to question.
Cole, Sarah Williams, and Colin Letts collaborated on the sculpture called Banned, Challenged, and Censored, featuring books meeting those criteria.
We wanted something that was, you know, artistic, had a sculptural element, so it wasn't simply a display. And we wanted some kind of iconic imagery, such as the top of the piece with the bars and ripped up book pages and barbed wire, which is kind of iconographic of censorship and desecration and entrapment and banning.
Cole says the piece weighs more than 350 pounds.
It's 83 inches tall, and it uses metal, steel, patina, finish, and plexiglass, but also, perhaps most importantly, it has over 30 books, actual books, that have been banned or challenged in the sculpture. And then it has torn pages, like Colin mentioned, that indicate sometimes what happens to literature when it's challenged.
Books sit on individual shelves against a wall plastered with pages of books and magazines.
We have James Joyce down here. We have Mark Twain over there. Christie the wordsmith talking about body language there, B-A-W-D-Y. And we have here a guide to Pulp Fiction. So we wanted to tear a lot of the samples of literature that have had their problems and include that too, so it's more complete picture. Harry Potter is up here.
Cole holds up a copy of the controversial Rolling Stone cover featuring the surviving brother charged in the Boston Marathon bombing.
And people objected that this picture was way too kind and favorable. Well, underneath, they talk about him falling into radical Islam and becoming a monster. But it's an example of what publishers, writers, film producers, artists face all the time about when are you at the edge of acceptance and when does individuals or groups step forward and say, we want this off the shelves.
A Light in the Attic, which is poetry for kids by Shel Silverstein. I think that came out in the 70s. Catcher in the Rye, of course, which many of us read in high school. It's one of the most books that has been challenged.
Flathead County Library Director Kim Crowley lists books the library has put on display that are available to borrow and have been banned, challenged, or censored.
Right now, the biggest reasons are contentious social issues like homosexuality, and sex is always a big thing. If there's, you know, too much sex.
Crowley gives 50 Shades of Grey as an example of a book that's been popular, has a lot of sexual content, may not necessarily have a strong literary value, and has been challenged in some places.
And many people say that any library worth their salt has something to offend everyone. So you and I might not have the same reading tastes, but you can find what you want to read, and I can find what I want to read.
Crowley says libraries strive to have a broad, diverse offering to satisfy the reading tastes of their communities and maybe even challenge some people's ideas. The banned book sculpture will stay at the Kalispell Library until mid-September. It's already traveled to Bozeman, Butte, Billings, Missoula, and Helena, with Great Falls Public Library next on the tour. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
For several years now, Missoula's Roxy Theater has served as the headquarters of the International Wildlife Film Festival. Executive Director Mike Steinberg says the theater at 718 Higgins Avenue has essentially been underutilized since it was rebuilt after an unsolved arson burned the original theater to the ground in 1994. Steinberg, a longtime film programmer, says it's been a great facility for various events and film festivals, but is not living up to its full potential. In this evening's feature interview with Edward O'Brien, he explains an ambitious plan to do just that.
An unused theater is a very sad place, and I felt that sadness, and I thought, what can we do, and why aren't we doing anything? Because we own the place, and with my experience with other film festivals, I mean, that's the biggest challenge, is just having a venue. And I mean, the programming, not to sound cocky, but the programming is kind of easy. There's so many films out there. There's so many films that just want a screen. Yeah, so I thought, you know, let's bring this place back. So I approached the board with this idea after the festival and said, you know, here's a plan. We can have a small sort of renovation of the place, clean it up a bit. It's amazing what a paint job will do. And begin programming regularly throughout the year. Films, you know, that might never come to Missoula, the kinds of movies that generally art house films that could help support a revenue stream for the organization, as well as, you know, bring an audience in year round that would pay attention to our festival when it comes back around in the spring. Build a volunteer base to help support that. Build other bases within the community, other relationships within the community to help support our festival. And the board said, sure, let's do it. We raised some money through a rummage sale. There's some furniture that we let go of. There was some old video equipment. We also threw a bunch of old broadcast equipment up on eBay. You know, the stuff that we weren't using, formats that have come and gone, but apparently people still want to buy.
Maybe not so gone.
But gone for us, and we certainly wouldn't be seeing these formats to screen with. And made a few upgrades in terms of our technology, got some professional Blu-ray players. The money that we spent really went into the lobby itself and just cleaned that up. Did a refurbishment of the counters with a local artist and designer named Isaac Humble. Just did a really wonderful work with reclaimed materials all from right around here. A painter named Steve Krutek, who teaches here at the university, you know, did a nice stencil, wrapped the whole theater in this cool deco design.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little bit of that money to help support the marketing. itself, and now we're going.
Take some confidence. I mean, if it didn't work when it was reborn after the fire in 94 as a second run, and then there was another attempt to bring films in, and the Crystal Theater filled this from Missoula old-timers, who will remember that, the art house, if you will, films. They did that for a while. It didn't work. What gives you and your colleagues the confidence that it'll work this time?
Well, it's a different world, for one thing. The landscape of independent cinema is much different than it was in the 1990s. I mean, the 90s were really the heyday for the Crystal, and I remember it fondly.
Sure.
But what's really changed is, like I said, this landscape of independent film. There's a lot more film available. There's a lot more smaller distributors who don't have the overhead of 35mm prints and advertising costs that were much steeper. You know, they can make a film available on Blu-ray and have a website to get the promotion out there. And they're willing to deal with small theaters. There's an organization called Art House Convergence, which is kind of a collective of art house theaters, independent theaters around the country. They meet every year just before Sundance, in Park City, in fact, and do their Art House Convergence. And the keynote that was presented this last year addressed this idea of a brave new art house, a way for independent cinemas like, you know, local purveyors of like restaurateurs or coffee shops, or the, you know, this real local sense that is alive throughout the United States and in towns like Missoula, this brave new sense of how things can be done. And the Crystal was certainly had a local vibe and was a local organization, but perhaps it wasn't as universally supported, this idea of local that I think has infected a lot of America.
Meaning it was before its time? Is that what you mean?
I kind of think it was a little bit before its time. I mean, but also it was from a tradition of art houses that were around the country in college towns, you know, like Madison, Wisconsin, like Columbia, Missouri. But I think the perfect storm, so to speak, hadn't happened with the availability of films and distributors that made it possible.
I see.
But there's a aspect, it's a certain nuanced aspect, I suppose, of local that has changed. And I think Missoula is a town that's always valued Missoula and always supported Missoula. And I think that's what we hope to see with the Roxy. And that's, in fact, already in opening weekend, that's the vibe that we've gotten. So that's great.
Talk about the changing landscape within the art house community. What about from the audience side of thing? And I always raise this when you're here because it's fun to talk about, and that is this new availability of films. If I want to watch something, I turn on my Apple TV and I go to Netflix or I go to whatever, and other people with their Rokus, or they go to Redbox at the grocery store. Is the market there, or has that changed so dramatically in this digital age?
I think the market is there, and you know, there's an experience that you can't get from Redbox or your Apple TV, which is the social contract of a commitment to sit in the dark together with strangers. Mm. Or in this case, people you might know. You know, I mean, it's Missoula, right? Mm-hmm. That experience is never going to go away. And it's certainly the challenge that any exhibitor, whether you're a major chain like Carmike, for example, or small independent cinema like what we're trying to do with the Roxy, that's the challenge of today. And I was just talking to a friend of mine explaining what we're doing. He's from Italy. I think I was pretty American-centric or something in my description of what's happening and how I felt like, well, the challenge is to get people to theaters. And he said, hey, man, that's everywhere. That's in Italy, too. Mm. So it's just a reality. We have convenience. We have access. Yeah. However, knowing about those films, knowing, you know, if you read IndieWire or you read blogs through IMDb or wherever, there's a much greater awareness of films. And certainly there are people like myself, like you, like many of our listeners who want to go to a movie theater and experience, you know, on a large screen, again, that social contract of being in a darkened theater with people in your community to watch and to experience a film. The other aspect is, even though there's so much of it out there, so many films available on VOD or wherever you're finding them, the Roxy is a curated program. And here's a film put right in front of you. You know, mainly these films, with the exception of a few that are simultaneously VOD, or usually not on Blu-ray, but sometimes these distributors are doing VOD and theatrical.
VOD meaning video on demand.
Video on demand, yeah, sorry. With a few exceptions, none of this stuff is actually available right now. You could be stubborn and say, I'll just wait, which I don't like to hear. The other exceptions, of course, are the classic films that we're screening, like we're doing Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Ooh. Okay, readily available. I believe it's on Hulu, okay? I believe you can go find...
On the Criterion?
The Criterion feed, the Criterion channel on Hulu. You can find it, okay? It's not hidden anywhere. However, once again, large screen, communal experience. There's this great YouTube clip out there of David Lynch talking about iPhones and watching movies on iPhones. I won't repeat it because it's a bit obscene, a little lewd. But honestly, if you're going to watch that movie on your iPhone or your iPad... You know, get a life. And the same is true. I mean, not everything we're doing is so cinematic that it must be seen on a big screen. But, you know, a film like From Up on Poppy Hill, the new Miyazaki film, it's extraordinary. Absolutely beautiful anime. And yes, in September, it will be available on video. And if you'd like to wait 2 weeks, you can go track it down. We certainly hope you'd come and support the Roxy Theater in screening it in our town. But, you know, if that's the way you're going to be, I don't know what we can say about that.
If I want to see The Seven Samurai, what sort of video quality could I expect at the Roxy? Will I get that Criterion, the beautiful redone, remastered edition, or will it be the scratchy, you know?
Oh, I don't know. What should we do, huh? At this point, yeah, absolutely. So we have wonderful high-def video projection. This will screen off of Blu-ray. It's, in fact, the Criterion edition, since that's who, you know, we're dealing with as a distributor. You know, in terms of the classic films, we're hoping to outfit the Roxy with 35mm projection, which sounds like we're kind of going back, whereas other theaters around the country are desperately seeking out, you know, DCP or digital cinema package. But the trick is, you know, kind of like how vinyl came back and people want to hear their music on a record, you know, we'd love to present some of these classic films on 35. Not just for the novelty of it, because, of course, it's gorgeous. A clean 35mm print, you just can't beat it. And certainly for distribution of modern films, it makes less sense. This technology is fine. Having DCP or having Blu-ray to exhibit a film from looks great. But if you see something like a classic Hollywood film, I mean, take Chinatown, for example. I'd much rather watch Chinatown on 35 than any digital format.
We've talked a lot about film. What about live performance?
Well, we've got this third screen. It's a 50-seat theater. You know, bring in some other seats. Probably can, our capacity is probably somewhere around 75. And we're going to have regular live events. We start off in August with a live concert from the local band Butter. It's a small venue, but it's really nice and intimate. And, you know, we can't imagine getting Bob Dylan to play there ever, but wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, that'd be something else. concessions, beer, wine?
You know, we don't have our beverage license just yet, and we're really hoping to get that by the fall because, I mean, we're in an era now where people expect beer with their movie. It's Missoula,
right.
And we would like to cater to that. We are supporting local purveyors as much as we can, and some of our concessions, for example, coffee from Black Coffee Roasting Company and Great Harvest Bakery is producing a special brownie that you can only get at the Roxy Theater called the Kubrick. Our popcorn is 100% organic. The corn, the oil, the butter, completely organic, and almost all of it's locally sourced butter from, you know, Lifeline and Victor, Montana. So, and I think that's a huge part of the culture that we're trying to support, this idea that we're locally grown and what we provide should be as well. We also have Milk Duds and Raisinettes, you know, because, come on.
It's a movie.
It's a movie,
it's
right?
A movie house.
For August, we're running two films Thursday through Sunday. It'll change up a little bit in September, and Thursdays are going to become kind of specialty nights. We'll have a community night. We'll get a cult film night going in there. We've already talked about some special series that we'll run, a Native American program that we're hoping to get going by October. But currently, it's Thursday night through Sunday.
If you want to find out more information, theroxytheater.org, right?
Correct, yeah. Or just come on down. I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Super. Hey, Mike, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Mike Steinberg is Executive Director of the International Wildlife Film Festival.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow calls for partly cloudy skies with highs in the 80s. For central Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy with isolated thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce small hail and heavy rainfall. Lows will be in the lower 50s. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms through the day. Highs will be around 70 to 80 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight look for mostly clear skies with lows around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be around 75 to 85 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. This evening, I would like to share some of my perspectives about the issues raised in a recent Frontline episode on public television. It was called Life and Death in Assisted Living. First, let me explain what an assisted living facility is. They were created to serve as a middle point in the continuum of care for older adults who could no longer handle many of their activities of daily living, but were not necessarily eligible to meet the level of care for a nursing home. Elderly residents would live largely independent lives and receive primarily non-medical assistance for things they could no longer do on their own. According to the Frontline story, this has all changed. The episode was co-produced with ProPublica and used reporters to investigate allegations of understaffed and underqualified assisted living facilities operated by a Seattle-based Emeritus Senior Living, the largest for-profit assisted living chain in the country, with facilities in nearly every state and about 40,000 residents. Emeritus makes more than $1 billion in yearly revenue. I don't want to get into the details of the episode tonight, but I encourage all listeners to go online to www.pbs.org and click Frontline on the menu at the right. Life and Death in Assisted Living is well worth watching. My reactions were anger, shock, and disappointment at the reality of how some, not all, assisted living facilities are evolving as an industry, one of which many families entrust the care of a loved one. I felt the pain of family members who naively believed they had placed their loved one in a facility where good care was given because that's what they were told they would receive for the money they were paying. After viewing this program, I encourage anyone who has a loved one in an assisted living facility or is considering placing a loved one in an assisted living to know their rights. Do not assume proper care is being delivered at all times and absolutely know who you or a resident can turn to as an advocate should concerns arise. Part of the problem is that assisted living facilities are not well regulated. For example, in Montana, the regulation for staff-to-resident ratio is loosely defined as providing adequate staff to meet the needs of the residents. What constitutes adequate staff is left to the interpretation of the administrator, who answers to a corporation whose motive is largely profit-based. On the other hand, rights of residents are clearly defined. They are intended to be much the same as when you live in your own home or an apartment. You have the right to privacy in your room, in communications like mail, phone, and visits, and while receiving personal care and medical treatment. You may have your own belongings, pursue your own interests, and participate in activities inside and outside the facility. You also have the right to leave and the right to stay. You have the right to access health care providers of your choice, rehabilitation services as you need them, and special diets per your request. Lastly, you have the right to be free from abuse, neglect, discrimination, exploitation, retaliation, and restraints. Earlier, I mentioned that all residents and family members have access to an advocate who does not work for the facility. These advocates are called long-term care ombudsmen, and they are employed by area agencies on aging. Their responsibility is to ensure residents' rights are being met. An ombudsman can serve as a liaison between a resident and or family member and the facility. Their goals are to make sure concerns are resolved and the resident is receiving the care he or she needs. Ombudsmen visit facilities regularly, and a poster in each facility lets you know how to contact them. You may also call 1-800-551-3191 to reach the area agency on aging that covers that facility. As we age and our care needs increase, it becomes essential to have someone who will help advocate for our proper care. It starts with a family member or friend who asks questions, observes care, participates in the care team meetings, and will call an ombudsman if issues are not getting resolved. I don't want to paint a broad brush that all assisted living facilities are bad. There are many good ones out there. I simply don't want any of you to end up like some of the families on Front Lines episode, Life and Death in Assisted Living. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services. As always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.